From the Danker Studio on Library Square, this is The Rundown, an exploration of local news, events, and issues that matter to you. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, we'll begin, as we always do, with your summary of the day's top local headlines. And through the summer here on The Rundown, we're rebroadcasting a few of our favorite feature interviews from the past year. Today, it's a conversation from last July with Brad Westwood, director of the Division of State History and the Utah State Historical Society, on the regional celebration that is Pioneer Day.
People can enjoy this whole experience and feel, even if they're not a Mormon, they can get in and enjoy this grand 24th of July celebration.
All that and more coming up on The Rundown here on KCPW. First up, though, a bulletin of world headlines from the BBC. And welcome back to The Rundown. I'm Roger McDonough. Coming up on the program, a conversation with the director of the Division of State History and Utah State Historical Society about Pioneer Day. But first up, we have these headlines. Fire crews in northern Utah are working to control two fast-growing blazes. The Anaconda Fire, 5 miles northeast of Tooele, had burned about 1,100 acres of brush by Wednesday morning. Fire investigators believe lightning ignited the blaze that is now 25% contained. Residents have returned to their homes after an estimated 15 houses were evacuated Monday evening. Roads leading in and around the fire are closed as crews from a number of agencies are working to contain the blaze. Slightly cooler weather on Tuesday helped crews gain ground on the Tunnel Hollow Fire, 5 miles east of Morgan. A stretch of Weber River from Croydon to Morgan remains closed to tubing, rafting, and kayaking. That blaze has charred about 1,200 acres. Utah's Elections Office is forming a new advisory committee to study whether the state should expand online voting. Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox, whose office oversees elections, says the committee will be made up of state legislators, county clerks, and technology and security specialists. Cox's office announced in a statement Monday that the committee will complete a study by the end of the year and present their conclusions to the state legislature. Utah has allowed members of the military and registered voters who are overseas to vote electronically since 1998. Lawmakers this year expanded the option to include disabled voters. Cox's office says the advisory commission will have to review security, secrecy, and accuracy concerns related to electronic voting. West Nile virus has been found again in Utah mosquito pools, and health officials are urging residents to take precautions to avoid contracting the virus. Rebecca Ward, a health educator with the Utah Department of Health's Bureau of Epidemiology, says that while the virus has been detected in mosquitoes in various pools of standing water around the state, no human cases have been reported yet.
The virus is in mosquitoes, and it is in Utah. We have now 5 positive mosquito pools throughout Utah. We do have some in Uinta County, some in Box Elder County, and we had recently 2 more positive pools reported in the southwestern area in Washington County.
Ward says that common sense measures should be employed to help combat the virus.
So to avoid even the possibility of becoming infected with West Nile virus, the best thing to do is to use insect repellent and to use some environmental measures such as removing kind of puddles or standing water around your home where mosquitoes can breed. Things like bird baths, swimming or wading pools, old tires or buckets or, containers that may have water in them that stands and becomes stagnant. Even a pet's water bowl. Change it out every day or every other day just to make sure that, you're not going to have that stagnant water there that the mosquitoes can breed in.
Not all mosquitoes carry the virus, but anyone bitten by an infected insect can contract the disease. Symptoms can include fatigue, aches, a rash, disorientation, and fever.
If it progresses to the more serious form of West Nile virus, it would be the West Nile fever, and that can lead to hospitalization, disability, and even death in some cases. And the symptoms may include a high fever, severe headache, stiff neck, become disoriented, confused. So if you are experiencing any of those symptoms, probably within 2 to 14 days after you've had a mosquito bite, you want to see your health care provider. There is no vaccine for West Nile virus, and there is no specific treatment.
Health department officials say West Nile watch season will continue through the summer and into the fall. And finally today, a jury has faulted state and local agencies in the 2010 deaths of a Utah married couple kayaking in the Jordan River. Family members of Kelly Fry Glasser and Joseph Glasser on Tuesday won their case, arguing that officials were aware of a deceptively swift waterfall. They also say overgrown weeds obscured warning signs. The jury on Tuesday awarded a $2.4 million verdict to the family. It found Murray City, which owns the bridge over the fall and concrete underneath, to be 50% responsible for the deaths. The Salt Lake Tribune reports that Murray, Salt Lake County, two state agencies, and two contractors had already settled for a total of $1.25 million. Officials say the couple was wearing flotation devices when they were pulled underwater by an undercurrent. And that does it for our summary of the day's top local headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and you're tuned into The Rundown. We'll be right back. And welcome back to The Rundown. I'm Roger McDonough. During the summer here on the show, we're revisiting some favorite interviews we've brought to you over the past 12 months. Tomorrow is Pioneer Day, a regional celebration of the arrival of the Mormon pioneers to the Salt Lake Valley 167 years ago this month. So today we're rebroadcasting a conversation about the history of Pioneer Day with Brad Westwood, director of the Division of State History and Utah Historical Society. Again, this interview originally aired last year. What was the first Pioneer Day like? Is there a record of it? Or, you know, how far back do Pioneer Days go?
You know, it's a great question because it's not an easy answer. The official legislation, or when it becomes official state holiday, is 1882. But you have celebrations pretty much since 47. And there's that hypersensitive history that Mormons are so well known for. And so this idea that they've come to a new land, that they're starting this new enterprise, people were writing in their journals and their diaries. They would have big banquets and celebrations. But the 24th really evolved into a fairly big event not many years after. The one year that does strike an interest for me is 1857. The pioneers, everyone's up in Little Cottonwood Canyon. They're celebrating that 10th anniversary. They've made a big flyer or a broadside that they pass out everywhere, and it has a little cannon on it, and, you know, come to Little Cottonwood Canyon, let's have a big celebration. And it is then that there's official public news that Johnson's army is in Wyoming, that Utah, or the territory of Deseret, is somewhat under attack, and everyone is sort of brought to guard, and this whole idea of Johnson's army and the possibility of the U.S. Army coming into Utah really comes to the fore publicly, and it's during the holidays, during the 24th of July celebration. So it's really been going on a long time.
That's interesting, and this is the beginning of the so-called Utah War. This speaks a little bit to the conflicts between Mormons and the federal government, but also to a certain extent the persecution the Mormons had faced and the reason that they came to Utah in the first place.
Well, yes. You know, I'll tell you something that makes the 24th fascinating to me is it's just a few weeks after the 4th of July. And July, to me, is the push and pull of Utah and its politics and its sense of identity. You have everyone celebrating the Independence Day and our nation on the 4th, and of which we've always been big flying people here in Utah. We love our nation, and yet at the same time, we love our independence. And so on the 24th, we celebrate this sense that Utah is its own little state and has its own identity, but more importantly, that it started as a, at least so far as the European pioneers of 1847, as a distinctly separate place. And so this push and pull is always playing out in July, and I'm fascinated by it. And even newcomers to Utah will really kind of engage in this big celebratory thing.
You know, and we should talk a little bit about what the 24th of July actually commemorates, the arrival of the pioneers into the valley in 1847, beginning actually a couple of days earlier. I believe it's Brigham Young and his cohort who actually show up on the 24th.
That's right. They all arrive, and they're somewhere around Temple Square. And Brigham Young pretty much says, you know, okay, we're here. Before that, of course, they have the famous utterance, this is the place, you know, over the hill. But also a group of the church leaders go to what's called Ensign Peak. And I would tell any listener, if they have an opportunity, take that quarter-mile hike up on the north side of Salt Lake. You get an incredible panoramic view, and you get this sense of the Mormon pioneers really saw this as a place of gathering. But it, like you say, it's 47 when everyone assembles on Temple Square, and they say, "Okay, this is where we're gonna camp. This is where we're gonna start our little territorial arrangement." And not very long after, they start doing the surveys, the engineering work. They start sorting out where the best land is. Crops are planted. And, of course, just in the nick of time, because it's the 24th and you're 6-8 weeks into the growing season. You know, Mormons, even today, love the idea of the pioneers, and so much so that the LDS Church has purchased land and have arranged with various federal agencies and to do these little treks, these pioneer treks, where they try to reenact the handcart pioneers. And you know, they suffer hard for a day or two, but they kind of viscerally feel the experience of being a pioneer. This whole pioneer thing is just a constant. Each generation kind of recontextualizes and makes it new.
Yeah.
And you know, and one thing that crosses my mind over and over: you don't have to be a Latter-day Saint to appreciate this whole pioneer thing. I think when I was living in Philadelphia, there was the Quakers, and even though I think I only saw a few Quakers in all the time I was living there, they were alive and well in their memory, and their imprint was just inseparable to Pennsylvania. And I think the same is with the Latter-day Saints. People can enjoy this whole experience and feel, even if they're not a Mormon, they can get in and enjoy this grand 24th of July celebration.
Fantastic. And so I want to talk a little bit about why commemorations like this are important, and maybe about the preservation of history in general. What are we doing when we celebrate historical events like this? What is the point of it? Why is it important?
You know, celebrations are unique to just about every group, or I think it's just a part of human nature. What makes this holiday significant is, well, first of all, that the people who settled Utah, I mean, notwithstanding the Indians and the Spaniards and, you know, the whole Mexican experience, really the growth of Utah comes with the Mormons after 47. And so looking back and acknowledging who we are, I think there's a certain morals that come, these little stories that we tell. It tells us about who we are. I have to say the holidays, the 24th, did change through the years. For example, it was you know, celebrating kind of an independence in the territorial period of Mormon of Utah. During the polygamy raids, when the federal government was bearing down on the Mormons and it was illegal to be a polygamist, they draped the streets and Temple Square in black during a period of time where they were sort of saying, you know, look at the tough things we're encountering. So it has changed. It becomes a kind of a political vehicle for whatever the feelings and attitudes of the time are. What I think is fascinating is that you go to just about any community in Utah, and that push and pull I described in the 4th and the 24th plays out. Some communities will do the 24th, some will do the 4th, but you can stop anywhere and really kind of understand those deep feelings about pioneers through particularly these smaller communities and their celebrations.
So while I've got you here, let's talk about the State Historical Society. What does the State Historical Society do?
Well, the State Historical Society is, I think, an incredible enterprise, because there are many other institutions. The LDS Church has its historical department. The Daughters of the Utah Pioneers has a museum. And by the way, everyone ought to go find their relic hall and go see a Daughters of the Utah Pioneers museum during this period of time. And there's universities that collect. But nowhere is there a place quite like the Historical Society, because it's the everyman's history. It's the place where pretty much no vested interests or narratives are being focused on. So we collect every community, every ethnicity. We try to understand the entire story of Utah, even contemporary history. And so we work very hard with many other repositories, historical ones, many other groups that are interested in history. But we try to be as accessible and as inclusive as we can with history. History is a wonderful pastime. We love it. It's one of the major interests on the web. It's what people love to read when they read novels. There's lots of the history engaged. But when you collect and document history, you're able to memorialize people. You're able to correct the record on things. You're able to see how things unfold. We are used in developing public policy. Good historical research will oftentimes sort of lay out where we ought to go in the future. We also are engaged in historic preservation. We encourage communities to maintain their historic sites and buildings. There's economic development that we're engaged in. There is a great deal of interest in eco-historical tourism, where people want to go to these little communities, see how things would look in the 19th century.
Right.
Even the 20th century. I mean, there's this big surge in mid-20th century modern architecture. And so the society assists communities in placing neighborhoods and buildings on the National Register for Historic Places. We also deal in archaeology and antiquities. We are the a unit that deals with making sure that when federal funds are used, that they don't harm cultural resources. We also have a library and the Historical Quarterly. So we really are trying to engage Utah's public in the vibrancy and the love of history.
Yeah, and we've been talking about Pioneer Day, but I could basically bring you in here on any day of the year, given the massive focus of the Utah Historical Society, and we could talk about any number of historical events and trends and threads. Maybe we should try that again.
Roger, any excuse will do to have a good time. And history has that quality about it. So love to do that. The library here in Library Square was a prominent part of Pioneer life. Just a block over, the City and County Building was a place where new immigrants would camp for a time. And there was years where brass bands would meet the pioneers. And, you know, there was a sense of accomplishment getting across the plains and through the mountains and arriving in Salt Lake City. That same joy and excitement about getting over a tough patch, overcoming something, traveling from afar, it's all played out on the 24th each year in Utah.
Wonderful. Well, it's something we can look forward to celebrating tomorrow. I appreciate your coming in here today, Director Westwood. When you first walked in, you mentioned that you have some events coming up.
Well, that's right. September, we have our annual Utah History Conference. We have 2 days. We partner with the Fort Douglas Museum up near the U. We'll have a day there, a day at the Rio Grande. You know, what's wonderful about the State Historical Society is we're housed in the Rio Grande train station. It was one of those early gateways of which our little development around us has evolved. It's also a gateway for people who come to want to understand Utah's history. From Broadway, looking west, you see the neon sign and the arches. You know you're on your way to the State Historical Society.
Brad Westwood, thanks again for coming in and speaking with us today, and happy Pioneer Day.
My pleasure, Roger.
And again, that was my interview from last year with Brad Westwood, Director of the Division of State History and Utah State Historical Society. If you'd like to learn more about Utah history, including Pioneer Day, check out their website, history.utah.gov. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks again for listening. Stay tuned for the Utah Business Report and Marketplace here on KCPW. And thanks again for tuning into The Rundown this afternoon. Our show is produced by Lauren Colucci. We had additional help from Jesse Ellis and Tyler Ford. Our theme music was composed by Tim Myers. Tomorrow, The Rundown's taking a break for the Pioneer Day holiday, but we'll return again on Friday. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening. Utah Business Report and Marketplace are coming up next.